people think you have to have millions of dollars in the bank to buy a business, and that's not necessarily the case.
You're listening to the Next Generation Podcast, weekly interviews with the most interesting and successful 20-somethings out there.
Ryan, what's going on, brother?
Hey, guys. Glad to be here. It's fun.
Ryan, I've been definitely looking forward to this conversation all week. This is going to be something a little bit different than what we're typically used to. I think in the past, we've done a lot of just like kind of bios and like diving deep into the background. And you've got a badass background. So I definitely want to go and like at least highlight that a little bit at the beginning of this episode. But today we're going to dive really deep into the concept of buying a business, because I think for a lot of people in their 20s, when they're getting started, all they can think about is like, how can I go and start a business for as little money as possible and try to go and make something like this work? And I think from knowing you for a couple months, or I guess maybe even over a year now at this point, you've definitely showed me that there's a lot of deals happening out there where people are buying like pretty big businesses without necessarily having to put up a lot of their own cash. So I want to just like spend a lot of time on today's call, like understanding like when does it make sense to buy versus build? And then also kind of like diving into a few examples of some creative financing that you've done in the past. But to maybe kick things off, do you want to maybe give the audience a little bit of your background and where you come from?
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, guys, for having me. So I've spent about 8 years in the tech world doing software sales. And then about 10 years ago, I got into acquisitions. I bought my first e-commerce company. I reached out to a business and wanted to buy them. And of course, they weren't for sale, and just kept hounding the guy every 2 weeks for about 3 or 4 months. And eventually said, hey, you're pretty motivated and I'm not, so I'm going to sell you the business. So that was kind of my first foray into buying a business. And then since then, I've started lots of businesses, everything from Amazon FBA businesses, Shopify content sites, to I even started a candy factory, scaled it to 60 employees. That was a nightmare. I wouldn't recommend that for most people. There's other ways to make money than manufacturing food with 60 employees. But kind of come full circle, went back to the roots of all things acquisition. So I've made, as a buyer or a seller, I've been a part of, I think, 12 deals. And then I'm also an advisor with brokerage with Quiet Light. So I do a lot of deals from a broker standpoint, but I've seen, you know, 50 plus at least that I've, from friends and family that I've been intimately involved with, either as just kind of an outsider or a fly on the wall. So I've seen a lot of deals happen. And this is, I think there's, you know, there's lots of different types of entrepreneurship, but one of the most, it's being talked about more, but it's still not talked about enough, is actually, you know, becoming an entrepreneur, being your own boss, but through acquisition.
Yeah. I think one of the common misconceptions there to what Connor was saying earlier is that everyone tries to think about, you know, how do I start a business cheap and how do I get it to, you know, grow and scale from there. But the missed part there is oftentimes you can buy some of these companies with significantly less money than most people would assume. And, you know, oftentimes maybe from a risk standpoint, if the company's been operating for 5 years, there's significantly less risk in that than trying to, you know, spend 20, 30 grand on your own company to, you know, hope it doesn't crash and burn.
Yeah, absolutely. I've started 10 companies and two were successful. You know, that's like, you know, that's not quite Hall of Fame if you're like, you know, in the major leagues playing baseball. But from an acquisition standpoint, I think I'm like 4 out of 5 in terms of like, you know, continually growth. And the fifth one wasn't that good of a purchase and it maintained, right? So 5 out of 5 for not losing money, which is much better batting than, you know, the other way around. So
on that note, before we even dive into all the other questions of like, you know, when does it make sense to buy and whatnot, for that fifth deal specifically, was there something looking back on it now that was maybe like a little bit of a red flag that you should kind of avoid in deals now, to know if a deal is good or bad?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and the first deal you look at is always amazing. And then you're like, this isn't the deal for me. Right. You got to look at a bunch of businesses. It's like, you go on a first date with someone, they're great. But you know, after a few more dates, you start to get to know them, which is why you date a bunch. So absolutely, that look back, and the main thing that I see, and this is a lot true with a lot of buyers, is you want to find a business that needs you. That business did not need me. It just was interesting and I liked it and the numbers made sense, but I didn't have the right skill sets to do anything with it. I either had to learn them or hire them out. Now, granted, most times you're not buying a business that's sending rockets to space or something. Like, you can learn the business model, but it's a whole lot easier when that business, it is screaming for the talent that you bring to the table, or the network, or whatever to the table. So that's the biggest difference between that fifth one that didn't do as well as I thought, is it just didn't need me.
And to clarify there, though, a lot of these companies, you're not buying them at really any scenario where you're going to be unprofitable, usually on a cash flow basis, right? Like, I'm assuming even that fifth company, you're probably still, you know, making money and still getting some sort of return on your investment of whatever you spent to buy it.
Yeah, absolutely. It flatlined. Like, it just didn't grow the way I expected. I expected we'd have a lot more growth. So I didn't technically lose money on it, but it also didn't, you know, 3 or 4x, which I thought I could do with it. And a lot of it was because I just wasn't the right person for that business.
Right. I want to take a quick kind of step back. What are you doing on like a day-to-day basis? Where are you spending your time right now? Is it kind of in the consulting range? Is it still running these companies, buying them, or what does that typically look like?
Yeah. So I've kind of come full circle where, you know, when you have 60 employees, and I learned very quickly that was not my skill set and I didn't like managing 60 employees. Some people love it. I don't. Right. And so I went the exact opposite route of more internet-based companies where I have freelancers and no employees. I don't actually have any full-time employees, but I work with a ton of different freelancers. And so a couple of my acquisitions, they require just a few hours a month. They kind of maintain, they continue to grow, do their thing. One that required a lot more time and effort, I actually brought in an operator who is absolutely fantastic. He's got the perfect skill set for the business. We created a package with some upsides and growth metrics that he needed to hit, some equity portions that he would hit. And if he is just even okay at his job, which I know he's phenomenal at, he's going to crush it and just do so well. From a day-to-day standpoint, I probably spend most of my time looking at deals. I spend a lot of time as a broker, right? So I help people who exit their online businesses. But it's never the same. Every day is a little different. And sometimes I get burned out of one area, and then it's nice to have the shiny object syndrome is helpful when you want to switch over to another project. And the thing I didn't talk about too is I have a podcast where I kind of talk about content. And I know, Connor, you've been on there before. I think Giovanni, we may have had you on there before. If not, we need to. But no day is ever the same, but I kind of like it that way.
It's funny hearing you kind of like rehash what we talked about. I want to say like 3 or 4 weeks ago when we were just shooting the shit on Zoom, it was like, 60 employees, not the fit, just doing it by yourself, like too stressful and too burdensome. I think what a lot of people are going to start finding, especially if you like don't want to build a massive business, but just really good lifestyle businesses, is having like that team of like 5 to 6 killers around you makes things so much easier. And it's like, from a management standpoint, a lot better. And honestly, like more fun overall, because like then you feel like you're part of this like team, everyone's self-sufficient. You're not necessarily like riding the coattails of anyone.
Yeah, you bet. I think everybody like, I've kind of gone full circle on everything. And like, you think about going down the corporate route, and I went down that path and I did the hall check, and I was like, you know what? I looked down the hallway and I don't want to be in any of these seats down the road. And so every kind of listener or entrepreneur or just, person out there needs to figure out what is the ideal lifestyle look like. And I've always tried to mimic people who had amazing businesses, made really good money, added a lot of value, but they didn't sacrifice their lifestyle. Like, I want to be able to coach my young kids' soccer games, or, we were just talking of some of the cool things you guys have done in the last 18 months and living in Airbnbs all over the world. Like, those are the things that I still want to do while I have good knees, not when I'm 65 and my knees suck, right? Like, so how do I may leave some upside on the table and not go build a huge business and a big team, but I can build these businesses that I think are pretty good and allow me to have this lifestyle, which then affords the flexibility that I want.
I think a lot of people are starting to slowly shift that route too, especially as like, I don't know, most of the people I'm talking to right now don't want to build the $1 billion business. They just want to make, a good amount of money every single year, travel around, spend time on hobbies, hang out with friends. Like, I completely agree with that. I want to shift the conversation a little bit more now to like actually thinking more towards like buying these businesses, right? Because this is kind of like your bread and butter and you see this stuff on a daily basis, right? So first, let's start off with probably the more obvious question and something you probably get a little bit more often, but it kind of helps set the scene, I think, for some of these younger people when they're like, well, why would I buy that when I can just go, why would I go and buy this blog that's all about, I don't know, pickleball or whatever like that, when I can just go and actually build it for myself and spend, a tenth of the cost. When does it make sense to basically buy versus build a business? And does that kind of shift based on like the macro environment that you're in?
Yeah, good question. So let me answer the first, and then let's dive into the macro environment, because I think that's helpful as we're seeing a lot of moving pieces with a war, interest rates, and everything. So on the first piece, buy or build, I think sometimes it's personalities, right? One of the best deal makers I know, he's actually a builder. He just loves building. And so in his case, every time he buys something, he's like, I just love building. And that's okay. There are builders and there are buyers. And I say builders, like builders from scratch. A lot of people who are buying, they're also building. They're just not starting from, day one. So a few things. When you think about buying versus building, a lot of times when you're trying to buy a business, you're trying to come in at year 3, year 5, year 10, right? So you're trying to basically bypass, you're paying that seller the right to bypass the first 5 years of that grind. what you don't know sometimes is if when you start from scratch, is that business going to work? You don't have any idea if it's going to work, and that's okay. That's just the risk that you're taking. So you know, if you've got a lot of time to kill, that's kind of a risk and trade-off. A lot of times people don't have the amount of time and they don't want to waste that time. So then they want to come in at year five or year 10. The main thing that I see is, and I see it a lot with people. And so every time I look at a business, I say, you know, is this cheaper for me to build it? Or is it cheaper for me to buy this thing? And sometimes it's actually cheaper to build. But then the next question I ask myself is, am I going to be willing to like run through the brick walls that need to happen to launch a pickleball website? Am I passionate enough about it? Do I have all the right skill sets to do it? And so those are the things that people need to ask themselves, because you can start a lot of different opportunities and a lot of projects and you just jump from project to project to project. But if you're starting something from scratch and you're trying to get it to where that business is at year five, you're going to have to go through that same grind you will with any other business. And so it absolutely makes sense to sometimes start from scratch, but you have to kind of off weigh it too, that, you know, if you start with a business that's 5 years old and it's already making 20 grand a month, you know, where's that business going to be in 5 years? It's probably going to be making 50 or 80 grand a month. And you're still just barely hitting that 20 grand a month. And you went through that grind. So I think there's kind of two areas. It's like, where do you want to be in a few years? And then the second piece is do you have enough passion and love for that industry and business to want to break through those brick walls? And that may be, yes, that might be okay.
Looking at it through the lens of someone that's, you know, maybe just graduated college or kind of early 20s, does that shift that perspective at all? You know, would you tell them, hey, come in, try to start a couple of businesses before you buy one? Or, you know, how do you view that conversation with someone that knows they want to be running a business, they don't know if they should buy, they don't know if they should build, they're kind of confused on, you know, exactly what path they want to be taking there?
You know, that's an awesome question. And it's a little tricky because everybody's kind of got their own path. And it's not like there's a right or wrong path, because we're all kind of doing our own thing. And I think that's the hardest part when you try to compare yourself to someone else, is you've got your own vision, goals, your own responsibilities, you know, your own risk tolerance. Some people have zero risk tolerance. I've met people that would be amazing at operating a business, but they just can't get away from that W-2. That's okay, right? That's just the right fit for them. And that's what's going to allow them to sleep at night. So, you know, early on, I think back, you know, so I graduated about 15 years ago. If I think about when I graduated, I wish I would have started buying businesses from day one, right? Immediately, very quickly. But that's kind of me and my personality. And I learned that I was not the best 0-to-1 guy. I was a lot better at evaluating a business, seeing, hey, the owner isn't doing X, Y, and Z. I know how to do that. Let me take it from, you know, 1 to 10. So part of it is personality. And part of it is, I think too, this world of buying businesses, like we can kind of get into this and we can talk about some deals actually, is people think you have to have millions of dollars in the bank to buy a business. And that's not necessarily the case. It usually isn't the case, especially when you're first starting out. I would say focus on a business that changes your life, and that could be 5 grand a month, and then worry about a business that's going to change the world once you've kind of been set up or you've had an exit or something to that extent. Most people think you need these huge, huge amounts, but in reality, you can go buy businesses with zero money down, right? You can take seller notes, and we can talk maybe about some of these examples, but that's kind of the misnomer that, oh, I got to go work for 15 years, save up $2 million, and then pump every single penny into this idea. And I don't think that necessarily is the case. And those are the stories that make for good movies, but you don't hear about the 5,000 other people that tried that and it didn't work. And now they're back to square one.
Yeah, no, that's smart. I think also on Gio, to that point too, like one thing that I think might go slightly untalked about as much during this actual episode is the idea that you should have some kind of tangible skill set that you know that you can move the needle with. And like, frankly, a lot of college students, when they go and graduate, just don't know shit about shit, right? They're not good at sales. They're not good at marketing. They have no product experience, right? And so Ryan, when you're talking about like finding a business opportunity where you think that you have some alpha because you're really great at marketing and the owner's doing no marketing today, right? Like that's where a lot of this opportunity comes from. I would say also like a totally simple route that you can go down is like, if you graduate from school and then just go and do sales for the next 2 to 3 years, or go and like only do, I don't know, content marketing and like focus really like on how to go and create good content and make like phenomenal SEO optimized pages, things like that, and like get this skill set. Now, when you go to buy these businesses, you're less looking at it from the standpoint of like, hey, you know, what are they good at? You're like, hey, are they not doing any direct sales? And there's an opportunity to do direct sales because now I can go and add incremental revenue given the past 2 to 3 years of experience I have from like just hitting the phones. So I feel like specifically for like the advice of a 22-year-old, that's also probably another like framework to look at it from.
Yeah, I think too, and I'm all about, you know, go out there and get some experience and whatever that might be, right? And as long as you're able to take that experience and roll it into the next thing. So I spent years in tech sales and selling software to big companies when I was 22, right? There's no reason why these companies should have been, you know, listening to me, but I was selling to them, which then allowed me to kind of create these partnerships. And so very early on, I was working with partnerships with access to all sorts of cool things, but that allowed me to then say, okay, well, how do I take these same partnerships and this partnership skill to then go out and find businesses where I can create more win-win situations, right? And a lot of like a simple example is like, say you have a software or some kind of company and you want to sell into a specific vertical or niche, find someone who's already got a voice in there, not your like Instagram influencer. It's more of like who's trusted in that space and then go partner with them or have an affiliate relationship with them. You're kind of pigging back on something that is able to do that. And we've built, you know, million-dollar businesses just doing that and finding people who've already trusted or already trusted in a space.
That's smart. Let's take a turn here now and maybe just start diving into some of like the actual like more creative financing routes that you've seen some other sellers or buyers go down in the past. I think maybe like the easiest way to go and do this is just like kind of breaking down either like a type of financing method or like a specific deal that comes to mind and kind of like just elaborating a little bit on like how that works. And we can kind of maybe just prod and ask questions once we're talking about it.
Yeah, you bet. I love talking about this because there's ways you can buy a business and you can read about them in a book, but then when you actually get in the real world, you throw all those ideas out the window, all those rules out the window. And it's just like, well, what does the buyer want? What does the seller want? And does that meet? You know, and if so, then a deal can happen. I want to put some caveats in here. So when you think about the normal traditional financing, it's like you go buy a business and it's like you go get an SBA loan or you get, you know, some sort of like backing that way. That's very traditional and a very good path to go. Now, as we talk about creative financing, there has to be a couple things that happen with creative financing 100% of the time. And you have to have one, a motivated seller. You have to have someone who really wants to sell their business. And then two, there has to be a lot of trust built up because a lot of the creative financing we'll talk about in some of these examples is delayed payments for the seller. They might make more money on the sale of the business, but they're going to be delayed. And so any delayed payment for a seller is risky because they may not get that payment down the road. And so that's where I think these two things are very critical is a lot of trust with the seller. And then also the seller has to be motivated to sell. Let me talk about one actually that I thought was super interesting. And I just heard about this business last night when I was talking to a buddy. So he had a boat rental business on the East Coast where they, you know, you could pay a subscription. I don't know what it was, maybe 100 or 200 bucks a month. And you just had access to all these like sick boats, fishing boats, wakeboarding boats, whatever. Right. This was an amazing business that he'd built up over the years, multiple seven figures in revenue, just doing great. But he actually ended up buying a different business. He bought a, you know, Main Street traditional service business out in the Midwest and moving out there. He wanted to exit his boat business because he wasn't living on the East Coast anymore. And there's a couple things that you can do, right? You can go the traditional path. You just sell it. He wasn't quite ready to sell it, but then somebody in his network just approached him and said, "Hey, can I buy this business from you?" And so they went the traditional path of like, what does an SBA loan look like? You know, oh, we have to get this external valuation firm and all this red tape. And then they basically went back to the table and said, well, what works for the seller and what works for the buyer? And the seller, he was more interested in passive income and the seller didn't want to sign a personal guarantee for some massive amount, millions of dollars. So what they actually did was a 15-year seller note, almost 100% seller finance. And what a seller financed note means is the seller of the business is actually financing it. So, you know, you're actually paying the seller back over time. And it could be 1 year, 2 years, 10 years. In this case, it was 15 years at a nominal interest rate. And that was actually the goal of the seller and the goal of the buyer. So the buyer now has this several million dollar business that they took over. They're going to be paying off this note and it's not going to take all their cash flow. They still have enough money to build the business, still have enough money to pay themselves. But the seller was able to get a 60% higher price than what was normal for that business than if he had gotten all of his cash up front. But now he's got a pretty good operator. He's trained them how to run the business and he can walk away. And for the next 15 years, he's getting paid. On the flip side, a buyer came into a multi-million-dollar business with almost no money down. So I thought that was a really creative way to go about, you know, kind of bypassing all the valuation firms and the banks and the red tape. And they both created a situation that worked for them.
That's really smart. I think the one question I would have there is like, what's the collateral on that, right? Like this guy goes, takes over the business, and this is kind of where like that trust element comes in that you're talking about earlier. But let's say he takes over the business and like somehow just year two, like phenomenally fucks everything up. Yeah, exactly. Like what happens then?
Yeah. So, I didn't ever see the APA or the asset purchase agreement. So I don't know all the details. What I would do to actually structure this deal to protect myself as the seller is I would have access to, you know, basically view only access to their Stripe account or however they're billing their customers. I would be a view only access user on their QuickBooks account. So I can actually see how the business is run. I would require monthly reporting and just quick updates. And especially for the first like year or two, I would actually be a little bit more involved. I'd get on calls for an hour or two every month to make sure there's a smooth transition after I've trained everybody. And then I would have some sort of clause there over a certain amount of time. Like if they miss payments, then there's, you know, fees that happen. If they miss a certain amount of payments, then I would, you know, try to take over the business. And after a while, when you think about a seller note, you know, a 10-year note or whatever, as you get to year five, the likelihood of that, the risk of that is a lot lower because you've already been paid on half of that. And as you, every single payment that's made, the risk for the seller starts to come down. So at a certain point, you know, maybe year eight or year 10, I'd probably just kind of waive that knowing that, you know, the business is in good hands and they're going to continue to run it. But that's a scenario where the buyer wants the seller to still be interested in the business. So they want them to stick around and they want that seller, if they get a text from the buyer, absolutely, they're going to respond immediately because they want to get paid for the next 15 years. So it actually creates kind of mutual alignment. And at the beginning, you just want to make sure you're heavily involved, but you've got some kickers in there to make sure that you're hitting and, you know, they don't run the business into the ground.
Are there any risk metrics that someone would be looking at in a deal like this in terms of, I don't know, their margin between the seller note and the expected revenue? Or I guess from a buyer's perspective, how do you make sure you don't have too much leverage and you kind of have enough skin in the game and cash flowing to actually keep growing the company every year?
Yeah. So in this case, what I would do is I would take the last like 2 to 3 years and get their average of like what the monthly average will be. And since boating is going to be sort of seasonal, like less people are boating in December, it's just cold. Doesn't matter where you are, it's cold, right? So you want to understand the seasonality of the business so you can actually tie your payments to that. So I don't know exactly how it's done, but you'd probably want to tie payments either to revenue so that if revenue dipped during December, you're still okay. When revenue is higher in July, because it's 100 degrees outside, that, you know, your payments are higher. When you're modeling something like that out, and say just for easy math, it's like you're making 20 grand a month. You want to make sure that there's enough room to grow the business, pay yourself, save for money in the business, and still make that payment. So you couldn't make a $20,000 monthly payment on $20,000 of profit because then you don't have anything to run the business and pay yourself. So in a scenario that I would like, I would want that to be below 50%, so below 10 grand a month. In an ideal scenario, it's closer to like 25 or 30%. And maybe that's, I don't know exactly, but maybe that's how they got to that point. We know, and that's why they extended over 15 years and actually increased the price. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Like if everything you're bringing in is going straight to the seller note, then how are you going to run the business? You can't pay yourself anything either.
So that might be an effective way on even how to structure the deal. Could be looking at, hey, this is how much cash flow we make every month. Both parties come to an agreement of like, this is a reasonable amount to be paying in a, you know, a note or sort of debt payment. And then maybe kind of reverse engineering of like, what is the term of that note? What is the interest of that note to kind of maybe equal out, you know, whatever that safe monthly payment is.
And sometimes the seller will have unrealistic expectations. They're like, well, yeah, like you make 20 grand a month. I need to get 20 grand a month. And this is where the buyer can actually come in and say, well, it doesn't work. The math doesn't work here. Let me show you why. And they just kind of back their way into it and saying like, I need X amount to run the business. I need X amount to pay myself. That's a very normal salary. And, you know, this is what's left over that we can actually pay you. And all of a sudden when it's, you know, it's as clear as mud there. And all of a sudden it's clear for the seller that like, oh, I can't ask for everything under the sun. And then we always kind of go back to like math and logic. Like, does the math make sense? And logically, does this make sense? Because there's a lot of emotions going on with the seller sometimes. And in this case, it's like, well, logically, you can't do that. And the math doesn't allow you to do that. So I think that's a really good way, Gio, to like go back into the seller's mindset to maybe get them down if they need to come down a little bit.
And so you've had kind of an overview of, I mean, this is kind of more of a physical service-based or location-based business. You've done a lot of the online businesses. Are there business models or business types that might be more conducive to the creative financing route than others?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if it's conducive to the business model so much as it is to the seller. Like the seller has to be motivated. Like a lot of times I'll say, like I'll run into a lot of buyers and, you know, I'll say, hey, what are your conditions for, what do you want to buy in a company? Like what type of company, what size, what are you looking for? And they give me these conditions that are literally like, they're describing probably the best company in the entire world. And first off, the seller's never going to sell because why? And then the second thing is, what makes them think that they're ever going to see the best business in the world when it comes to the market, right? So they're super unrealistic expectations. So when you get creative, there has to be some reason why the seller wants out. And it could just be life events. I've seen it for, you know, sickness or disease, or, you know, I sold one of my businesses years ago because my wife was going through a really difficult pregnancy. And it just was like, I needed to get offload one of my businesses. Could I have made more money if I kept it? Yeah, probably. But the timing was right for me to just move on. So when you think about different business models, there's content sites, there's e-commerce, there's SaaS, there's lead gen, there's a million different business models online. A lot of it, when you think of creative financing, is going to come down to what's most interesting to the seller and what works from a buyer perspective. Let me give you another example here. So somebody I know just bought a content site, you know, probably something you guys talk a lot about, probably talk a lot about online businesses. They sold a digital course and they also have some ads that come in. And the price started out at X and eventually they sold for about half of that. And, you know, I can kind of walk you out. And it ended up selling for about a 1.5 or maybe a 1.3X multiple. What that means is, for easy math, if the business is making $100,000, most businesses in that range are going to be like a 3X to a 4X, so $300,000 to $400,000. In this case, it was sold for $150,000. So if everything stays the same, you're going to make your money back in a year and a half, which is very, very quick in this world. Usually it takes, you know, 3 to 5 years without any growth. So in this scenario, this business was one of the best businesses I'd seen that needed this buyer, right? This buyer had the perfect skill set to take this business to the next level. It had a really good foundation. This buyer had no idea about the topic of the business, but what the business needed was someone who could run Facebook ads, someone who could, you know, do the digital marketing and basically create all the partnerships to drive more traffic there. And this person had been doing that for years and it was kind of the perfect thing. This person didn't have the liquidity to do this deal. And so it ended up starting at, you know, a 3X multiple and eventually got down to a 1.5. Basically, so the price of the business was cut in half if he was willing to pay up front. And this individual took out some personal loans to actually acquire this business. So I don't know if I like recommend this option. These are not your traditional routes. These are interest, you know, 7 to 8 to 9% personal loans that you would get from like American Express in the mail. But he bought a business that is still free cash flowing and he's going to pay off all of his debt within 8 or 9 months because he's already grown the business because it needed him. I thought that was an interesting way to create, you know, he didn't want to put any money into it. So he ended up borrowing 110% of the actual purchase price. And the other 10% he dumped into Facebook ads, which of course grew it because he knew exactly what he was doing. So I don't know if I condone that as much. There are, you know, we went from one extreme of 100% seller finance to the other extreme of like leveraging up 110% on personal loans. So anyways, there's a million different ways to kind of carve these up, but just, you know, out for your listeners, that's not financial advice.
Someone that knows that they're in a position where they want to buy a company, they're young, they might not have a ton of money, but they know, hey, the next year, 1, 2, 3 years, my goal is to own either an online business, maybe not even an online business. What's something that they might be able to do on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis to set themselves up for success, find deals, and actually kind of execute on one?
Yeah, good question. So I would say there's a few things I'm going to outline here. And first off, you want to start looking at deals now, right? So you're going to look at your first deal and it's going to look amazing. And then you look at your second deal and you look back at your first one and it sucks.
You know, how do you even find deals?
So some places to find deals. So depending upon, let's start with like the smaller range, you know, say you've got 10 or 20 grand, the areas you're going to be hanging out on would probably be like Flippa. That's 2P's, Flippa.com. EmpireFlippers.com has some lower deals there too. MicroAcquire sometimes can have some deals on there. So MicroAcquire.com. As you get a little bit bigger upstream, you're going to hit, you know, the bigger portion of EmpireFlippers.com, QuietLight.com. There's also a service, Centurica.com, which kind of aggregates a lot of these sites there together. There's also a motioninvest.com, which does a lot of like sub $50,000 content sites. So those are some of the resources that people can go, but you want to start looking at these deals now, even before you're ready, so that when something slaps you in the face, you're like, yes, this is a no-brainer. This is the deal for me, right? And you might go through 100 deals, 200 deals. I probably looked at, you know, in 2019, I bought a business. I probably looked at like 400 businesses that year. And I, you know, put an offer on three of them, and one of them I really wanted and went through with it. Right. So a lot of it's kind of the numbers. Now you talked about like what position to kind of put themselves financially. So that's where like start doing those things now. And I maybe on that same point too, you want to focus on similar type business models, because if you look at like the, you know, HVAC company locally or like the plumbing company locally, and then you're looking at an e-commerce brand, they're just not correlated in any way. You want to start to focus. And then on the flip side, as you get into, okay, the financial side, how do you put yourself up into the right financial position? So early on, you might have no money, you might have 10 grand, you might have 20 grand, right? You're going to be hanging out in kind of really low sort of crappy businesses. So that's a tough place to be in. Now you can actually learn a lot by having those smaller acquisitions. And I've seen people take $10,000 acquisitions and in 6 months turn it into $50,000 or $75,000 exit. So you absolutely can do that and sort of kind of flip those content sites. What I would recommend is like, I think that like that first six figures, the first 100 grand you have kind of opens up a lot of doors. It opens up a lot of doors for you as a buyer, but also don't get caught up in what the exact amount is. And I think people, if they have the right skill set that a business is needed, there is so much money out there from investors and people wanting to diversify from the stock market, crypto, real estate, where you can give someone a 10 to 15% interest rate or part equity in the business, and you can actually go acquire the business to little or no money down. And I see this really, really common in like the $100,000 to $400,000 range, where you've got you know, some rich doctors or some rich people that you kind of know that are looking to diversify from their other investments, and you're the operator. They don't have the time. They don't have the time to find the deals or operate the deals. But I think that's one thing that I didn't realize till early on in my acquisition career, is there is so much money out there to borrow and you know, not necessarily borrow, but like get investors to kind of back you. And when you think about, you have some money down, you get investors to put some money down, and you get a seller finance and part of that, you can start structuring a really interesting deal where you put 10 grand in, an investor puts in 50 grand in, and you get another 50 grand of an equity injection or like a seller note from the seller. All of a sudden you just bought a $110,000 business, probably doing $30,000 to $35,000 a year. Now you can go in and grow that thing. Is that a huge amount? Well, no, that just add a zero to the end of it, right? This applies to basically any range of the business range that you could be in.
So step one though is start looking at deals, right? Get every perspective, but to your point, pick a niche to some extent and just kind of review those, find the good deal, and then, you know, worry about the money side second for the most part.
It's hard to round up the money before you have the deal.
Right.
Because investors are going to say, well, what are you going to invest in? What you can kind of have those initial conversations, but most investors aren't going to want to back you without knowing what the business is. But yeah. And having looked at probably 1,000+ deals in the last several years, the best thing you can do is start looking at deals really quickly. And usually it's like deal 20, deal 40, deal 50, before you start realizing like, okay, this is really what I want in a business. And then when that deal 75 pops out and it is like, this is the one for me, you know, to really go after it. And so I think most people, when you look at a business and you're paying a 3X for a business in Excel or Google Sheets, everything makes sense. Financially, the numbers make sense. Like, cause you're buying a business that, you know, projecting over the next 3 years that you're going to make your money back. Like you're making 33% of your money. It always makes sense, but the business doesn't always necessarily make sense for you. And that's where getting the reps in early, and it will feel like you're kind of wasting time, but at about 20 of these summaries and these business summaries and these business listings, it'll click in knowing what's right for you.
I think that's kind of on a side note, the biggest difference between buying real estate versus one of these companies as like a first investment is that you could buy one of these businesses for 2, 3, 4X annual profit. You're buying real estate at 10, 20, you know, 13 times annual profit. So your margin of error becomes significantly lower, but totally, totally different environments there. On kind of to follow up on the looking at deals, are there any very specific levers that are easy for first time purchasers to buy on? I know we were saying before, yeah, if you have a skill, to Connor's point, you know, maybe it's content marketing or Facebook ads. Is there one that you see as a, you know, relatively easy lever to pull on for someone that might not have a ton of experience with buying something within that, you know, call it under $200,000 range?
Yeah, good question. I don't know if there's like a specific lever I would think about. It's more of, I would say it always going to come back to what you bring to the table and having the skill sets needed. You know, if you're 21 and fresh out of school, you got to figure out what you're going to bring to the table and don't go develop those skill sets. And like Connor said, it could be sales, it could be content marketing, it could be whatever, it could be link building, it could be programming, right? It could just be, you know, understanding UX or conversion rate optimization or really any of those things. But what you bring to the table is so critical. And then I think as you start to round that out, I think when it comes back to like what I think building true net worth is and true wealth, it really comes back to equity. So a lot of these things you can do for others, you can work for an agency. A lot of times agency work is not the most glamorous and you have a lot of crappy clients, but you get to put on a lot of different hats and you learn while someone else is paying you. And then eventually you got to flip the script so that you own equity in some of these businesses, whether that's through buying or whether that's, you know, you partner with someone and say, hey, I'm going to take over your marketing, you know, it's performance based. And if we hit X, you know, above your current growth rate, then, you know, I get 50% of that. There's just different ways to structure it, but it always is going to come back to, you've got to bring something to the table. And I guess it doesn't always have to be a skill set. It could be something as like, you've got a massive Rolodex, or you know the right people, or you've got the right financial backers. So there's a lot of ways to bring something to the table, but you got to bring something to the table.
Smart. Well said. I think the last thing that I would personally love to know as we're kind of wrapping up here is, you mentioned a little bit earlier in the conversation here, rising interest rates, impending war, people talking about recessions, layoffs, all of the fun, dark and gloomy topics here. I would imagine that while those topics are not fun, they also lend themselves to be much more conducive to getting way more motivated sellers wanting to go and sell their businesses. How are you personally thinking about the acquisition market and maybe like what you are doing to kind of prepare for anything like that over the next couple of years?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think in the 2010s to 2020, we basically have like the best economic run of all time. Like it was amazing, right? You could throw money at whatever and you made money. COVID hit. A lot of the sellers who probably should have sold businesses in the 2010 range in that decade, times were so good that they didn't want to sell. COVID hit. A lot of people came to market and were like, I just need to get out. Now, fast forward a little bit further, we had a lot of money printing, inflation, all that stuff's happening. We're kind of in the middle of 2022. And so I think we're seeing a few things on the macro scale. On the online side of things, I have definitely seen things slow down since February when, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine, there's a war going on. So anytime there's uncertainty, you start to see things pull back a little bit. You also started to see the stock market's kind of been wrecked the first 6 months, crypto's down like 50% from its highs. A lot of this online side and some of these Main Street businesses are less impacted by the stock market, but they're more impacted by the sentiment of what's happening in the greater economy. So we're starting to see things slow down a little bit. Interest rates are rising. So if you're taking a traditional loan and buying a business with it, the one thing about that caveat is, if you buy, say you bought used an SBA loan from a bank, which is a government-backed loan to buy a business, and you borrowed $1 million. If that interest rate went from 6% to 7%, so that one jump from 6 to 7, it's only going to increase your monthly payment by about $450 a month. So you're talking like a multi, you know, over $1 million business. It should kick off 30, 40 grand a month. If that $400 increase makes it so the deal isn't attractive, then the deal isn't attractive at 6% either. Don't buy the business. And, you know, if it jumps from 6% to 8%, now you're talking about $900 difference a month. Yes, that's a little bit more, but if it doesn't make sense at 8%, it doesn't make sense at 6%. So I think when you think about the interest rates rising, they don't have as much impact. I think it's the greater sentiment of what's happening of, you know, are we going into recession? Stock market's down. In the tech world, there's a ton of layoffs. We're seeing that across the board. So on a macro level, what we're seeing is we're starting to see multiples come down a little bit. But good businesses sell regardless of what's happening. some of the best businesses in the world right now were started in downturns, right? Were started in times that weren't that good. I think what was happening is there was so much money flowing around that a lot of mediocre businesses were selling a year ago, 2 years ago. And I think those mediocre businesses aren't going to sell, or they're not going to sell at those higher multiples at like the 3.5 or the 4X. So what I think is happening is the good businesses are always going to sell. A good business on a multiple, maybe, you know, a year ago, we got a 4X or a 4.3. Now it's probably selling at a 3.5X. You know, it's still going to sell. It's going to come down a little bit, but that's the biggest difference that I'm seeing is the mediocre businesses aren't going to sell as much. What does that mean from a buyer perspective is you're going to have sellers who are now more motivated to sell, which probably the expectations for an exit will be a lot more reasonable. And what I would do is kind of hold on to some cash for a little bit, at least, you know, keep some liquid cash, because I think over the next year or two, you're going to have some amazing buying opportunities. People, their businesses have gone through COVID. They went through this amazing time for the last 18 months, and now they're getting kind of wrecked again. They're going to be a lot more motivated to sell. And I think you can pick up some good businesses at much lower multiples.
Seems like we're the perfect timing for this podcast then. So
yeah,
start looking at deals, start making offers. And, you know, it'd be cool to hear some feedback if anyone actually ends up listening to this and, you know, gets one or two deals under their belt in the next year or two. So let us know if that's you. Ryan, thank you for coming on. I think this is an awesome episode. We have so many more things to discuss on this side, but I think we covered some really cool things. Where can people find you if they kind of want to follow maybe some of the businesses you're running, get some advice and see what you're up to?
Awesome. Thanks guys for having me. This is a ton of fun. So I have a podcast called Let's Buy a Business. You can follow me there. You can also follow me on Twitter, Ryan Paul Condi, or letsbuyabusiness.com.
Amazing. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks guys.
If you thought today's episode was awesome, we would love it if you would leave a 5-star review on the podcast, either on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It makes a huge difference and lets us get cooler and cooler guests for future episodes.